Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, coming from the Progressive Radio Network, where you can find years of archives of Expanding Mind, and you can also check those out in many other texts as well on my website, technosis.com. I was very lucky to come of intellectual age at a very interesting and fervent time and place, which was Yale University in the mid-1980s. Yale was a hotbed of deconstruction and critical theory, and so there were a lot of wild and crazy ideas flowing in from France as well as many other places. And it was a very heady time where my own already existing interests in alternative religion, consciousness, science fiction, weird fiction met a variety of very powerful philosophical and theoretical ideas, many of which I'm still working with. But at that time, among all these powerful texts, there were two particularly talismanic texts that I remember came into my life almost as if they were kinds of strange drugs from another parallel universe or some kind of weird virus that was going to rewrite the way that I saw the world. And one of these was Jean Baudrillard's book, Simulations, which really got me going into my work on Philip K. Dick and a lot of the work that I later did. But equally talismanic was Donna Haraway's essay, The Cyborg Manifesto, or A Manifesto for Cyborgs, as we often called it, because we considered ourselves cyborgs of a sort, at least in terms of the way in which we were engaging with the new technological possibilities. And, you know, I can vividly remember the sort of dog-eared Xerox copy of this text that I marked up. At the time that she wrote this, Donna Haraway had just started teaching at the History of Consciousness program at UC Santa Cruz, a really fascinating and very vital program that's still growing strong and that really helps shape some of the ways in which I think about consciousness on this show. Professor Haraway had already been a student of biology and the history of science and was deeply immersed in issues in feminism and Marxism, materialism. And in many ways, she used the figure of the cyborg to kind of investigate and interrogate ideas within feminist socialism. And so she had very particular goals in mind with that essay, but it had this strange effect of radiating far beyond the zone of its closest alliances. You know, it was picked up by cyberpunk science fiction writers because, of course, cyberpunk was happening around the same time that the essay hit and indeed was responding to similar things, which had to do with the increasing awareness that we were entering into a different kind of society, a different kind of civilization, a different phase of technological development, and a different phase of capitalism. And in those earlier eras, sometimes the imagination is able to tune into figures, myths, images, chimeras that somehow speak with a strangely prophetic voice and open up gaps and cracks in the future almost. And this was one of those essays, as were a number of cyberpunk science fiction writers. And in many ways, in my own mind, these works are very similar. They, even though some occupy fiction and some occupy philosophy and politics, they're all sort of a strange kind of weave that remain extremely vital today. About a little less than 20 years later, Donna wrote a very different kind of manifesto, the Companion Species Manifesto, which really looked at the intimate, almost homely example of dogs as pets and as working animals as a way to interrogate and move further into some of the questions she raised with the Cyborg Manifesto, which had to do with how do we think about otherness? How do we think about the ways in which we are not essential beings, but are also constructed and built from our connections, from our practices, from our technologies, from our very crazy and messy biologies, which don't follow coherent patterns half as much as we might like to think they do. And so in a very different way, she continued to explore in an intimate and an imaginal way these very real connections we make with very significant others. And that's a phrase she used a lot. How do we deal and engage, connect with significant others, others who are so other that there's only so much connection that we can do, and yet we have nothing really left to do but connect. These two essays have now appeared in a new book, Manifestly Haraway, along with a really wonderful interview between Donna and Carrie Wolf, who I was also lucky to work with a bit at Rice University, where he was one of the readers of my dissertation. So it's a wonderful book, highly recommended, and I'm very happy that Donna Haraway agreed to be on the show. So Donna, thanks so much for joining me on Expanding Mind.
Hey, thanks for inviting me. I'm looking forward to talking.
Yeah. So, you know, I think, you know, just rereading the Cyborg Manifesto and, you know, again, marveling at how many trends and conditions that we're still living with. We're living with more robustly, more expansively, more terrifyingly in many ways. But many of the things that you keyed in on, I'd love to have you talk a little bit about, you know, again, why you chose to sort of create and construct a kind of new myth or a new figure at that point, rather than just being critical of the new dimensions or critical of problems in feminist theory. You were saying, okay, yes, there are issues, there are problems, but let's investigate them, but with a figure, with an image, with a kind of quasi myth, if you will, this sort of image of or figure of a cyborg. And you know, what was at stake in that kind of image, and then how does it look today? You know, that's my place to start.
Well, I think the most fundamental thing is that critique is never enough. It's like you absolutely do need to clean out your sink or your toilet from time to time, but that doesn't constitute living in your house. And I think that political people like myself and like you and like most of the folks who are probably listening are always faced with a kind of obligation to examine the conditions of unfreedom, the conditions of oppression, the lines of destruction, the implosions of destructive forces, and that critique in that sense is an indispensable practice and skill, but it's never enough. And storytelling, living in stories, materially, sensually, with each other, living in the figures that make the world real, both those that are destructive and that those that have some serious potential for more flourishing, more livable lives, living in stories has always seemed to me much bigger and much more fundamental than critique, or really includes critique. So storytelling and figuration feel to me built into the tissue of my bones. And I relate that to many things, including the fact that biology has been my first love among knowledge practices. And I don't think you can do good biology as a scientist or live thickly as an organism outside of narration, outside of stories. Certainly you can't do ecology, evolution, development, immunology, any of the really important domains of biology without understanding that figuration and storytelling are intrinsic to doing the science itself. So the cyborg stuff, the cyborg figure, wasn't exactly a choice. It was more a figure that seemed already to be thickly in our living and dying on this planet in a post-World War II extended historical time space, that cyborgs are born out of the interdisciplinarities and machines and apparatuses of global war and global capitalism, but never nothing but. And I was a feminist from the get-go. This is a period, I'm talking about the 1970s and 80s, in which the necessity of critiquing biological warfare in Vietnam, the electronic battlefield, the permanent Cold War nuclear apparatuses, the question of critique directed to the sciences was non-optional. And as a biology graduate student, I was part of the Science for the People Worlds opposing chemical and biological warfare in Southeast Asia. I was with other scientists deeply committed to doing science and also understanding how absolutely vicious the alignment of science and war machines and science and global capital was. So that I felt like we were already living a cyborg world, and it wasn't exactly a choice of a figure so much as a recognition of the materiality of living and dying, and also a kind of raw, ragged joy, even in information sciences, certainly in biology and including molecular biology as it was developing in the 70s and 80s. Understanding, I think, in my emotional as well as intellectual and political life, that these figures and these stories were who we are, and that needing to write them, think them, act them, somehow open them up to more flourishing was the kind of work that I and we needed to do.
Yeah, that you touch on something there that I find particularly helpful about your work for me, not just in terms of thinking about things, but in terms of inhabiting my own body and my own emotions, is the way that you find joy and possibility even in extremely difficult historical circumstances and conjunctions of forces. And also that you really insist in a way that I think I wish we all learned how to do better, of the way in which we need to claim and inhabit the violent stories that compose who we are in a way that we speak them, but that they are still able to be transformed. And you do that in the cyborg stories, and you do that in talking about dogs and in a great deal of your work. And I'd like to just stay with that a little bit, whether we're talking about our own individual stories, for example, what you just said about the science and technology and war in the 70s and 80s, of course, as you have often acknowledged, your own university training, your own capacity to be the kind of intellectual you are, to have the exposure to the knowledges that you've had, was itself partly a product of this environment, because the U.S. government says, yes, let's throw a lot of money at this, let's get smart brains, even Irish Catholic female brains, to be hopped up on this stuff so that we can do some work. And you tell that story. That becomes part of your engagement, part of your performance as an engaged person. And that ties in with this earlier thing about stories. So I'd love to have you talk a little bit about how, in dealing with the violent conditions of the 20th century, of the 21st century, of racism in America, et cetera, any innumerable situations we could talk about, how in dealing with them, there's a very important task in terms of narrating our own stories with their violence and despair in them, and yet somehow making a space for some kind of transformation, a transformation that comes through in your writing very strongly.
Well, it's transformation, but it's also recognizing that we're living many, many conjoined material semiotic stories, that we're not only living in the stories of violence and its perpetuations. I think cracking open the false view that violence occupies all the air in the room, that we are in fact living very complex lives with great vulnerabilities and precarities that are not distributed equally, for sure, and that the forces of destruction truly can and have, have wreaked astonishing damage and are and will wreak more, but that it's not just a question of transforming that, but recognizing that simultaneously we live in very robust lives that that deserve a present and a past and a future, that we are already living and dying with each other in ways that we need to become more aware of, more conscious of, to make stronger. So it's not just a matter of doing something new or transformative, but clearing out, you know, getting rid of the extremely destructive fantasy that violence occupies the whole space of what is. It doesn't. And
yeah,
find sustenance with each other, both human and non-human, in the kind of ongoing vitalities that make life worth living.
Yeah, I'm curious whether, since this is, I think, a problem that a lot of political people fall into, and other historians, everyone in many ways, they find some of the main issues that call them, they see realities exploding, you know, sometimes in their face, and the capacity to recognize that multiplicity, those different dimensions, including the ones that are necessary for enjoyment, for being with others, for nurturing, for a celebration, sometimes becomes extremely difficult to do. And I think part of the challenge is just that it's hard to think and to accept that degree of multiplicity, that we can be in contradictory worlds simultaneously, that there's always a meshwork, that it's complicated, that it has multiple sides. It's a very difficult thing to do, even for very intelligent people. And it may not even have to do with intelligence, the capacity to kind of live with that sort of multiplicity, with recognizing those different domains. What do you think was it in your life, in your temperament, in your experience, in your reading, that really kind of enabled you to be able to work with that joy and those connections at the same time that you're engaging in calling out some very heavy stuff?
Oh, I think that's a hard question to answer, because I think in some respects we pop out of the womb with certain kinds of sensibilities, not to be a biological determinist about it. But I think we all, you know, those of us who are engaged with each other in politics, in friendship, in making worlds, have different sensibilities, and we need each other's. And I think I have a capacity for laughter and a capacity for appreciation of the kind of wild humor of contradictions that crack open certain kinds of determinisms and false certainties. I think that partly comes from a family that loved language, a father who was a sports writer, and the kind of appreciation of storytelling and of what words do to you. I think it came from growing up struggling with totalitarianisms of different kinds, U.S. Cold War ideology, American Irish Catholicism, and then in various versions of Marxism later, the many kinds of doctrinaire totalitarianisms always on offer clash into each other. And I think at some level I've found these systems that claim totality so patently false as to be funny, almost. But I also think that the cultivation of friendship, the cultivation of kin, which aren't necessarily, which aren't even fundamentally one's biological, biogenetic family, but the cultivation of friendship and the cultivation of a capacity for pleasure, for art, for it's what's attributed to Emma Goldman. If I can't dance in your revolution, you know, I'm not, count me out. That the cultivation of the capacity for joy is part of living as a responsible person. And I think we cultivate that in friendship and in alliance. And in also, I think we are able to cope with contradiction as we strengthen each other in our ability to be wrong without lapsing into despair. The cultivation in each other of the capacity to take risks and be wrong, to do something kind of risky and fail in a kind of ongoing, loving way. Those, I think, these are habits of communities, habits of mind. And I'm a woman in my 70s now, and I think the cultivation of the capacity for humor and friendship are absolutely fundamental to any kind of lifelong political commitments.
Yeah, that really comes through with your conversation with Carrie as well. It's really interesting reading it because I know you guys are old and dear friends. And the way in which I really appreciated the way that that it was written down and edited, because you can see the way that the thoughts kind of flow between you, and there are points of contradiction, and then there are points of consonance. But it's almost more that there's sort of a kind of overlapping. There's this overlap of minds in there where you see the friendship, that sort of the affect dimension that surrounds the language and the ideas, and so it does a good job of modeling what you're describing. Another approach to that, of course, is your companion species at manifesto, which is so rich with joy, with the dogs that are in your life or were in your life at that point. The physicality of it, the essay famously begins with this magnificent, slightly perverse dog kiss that's just, you know, remarkable. That I had to, like, I was like, oh my god, this is so shocking. And then I was like, why is it shocking? I like to be kissed by dogs. I've had dog tongue kisses aplenty, and I was like, oh, why is this weird?
Why is it weird? And, you know, both the Cyborg Manifesto and the Companion Species Manifesto, both the cyborg who turned out unexpectedly to be a companion, to be a buddy even, and Cayenne and other dogs, those two figures and those two realities sort of imposed themselves on me. They were both a surprise. Cayenne was a surprise. The cyborg, the feminist cyborg, was a surprise. You don't set out to be this way. You engage in relationships that undo you and redo you. And I've experienced relationships with technologies, with knowledge practices, with political formations, with other animals, with many kinds of entities, as engaging in encounters that just undo you and redo you in ways that you couldn't possibly expect. And the Companion Species Manifesto was, you know, it happened because of this unexpected love affair with Cayenne, my sports partner, my teacher, this being. You know, I knew I was going to get a dog, and I'd had dogs before, but I didn't know it was going to be her. And the way a very particular personal relationship undoes you and redoes you, and you become capable of worldings that you didn't even know about before, much less know how to do. I think that any serious relationality, any relationality that we cultivate with a kind of open heart, makes us capable. Vincent Desprez puts it this way: we render each other capable. And I think both the Cyborg Manifesto and the Companion Species Manifesto were about relationships that render not just me, though there are many personal stories in both pieces of writing, but that open up possibilities for something we might call us, that open up possibilities for worlding together in ways that make sense. So the Companion Species Manifesto is at least as full of critique as the Cyborg Manifesto is. There's a different register of writing, different foreground, background, but the Companion Species Manifesto is full of accounts of labor systems and ecological destruction and on and on. It's full of trying to inhabit worlds for which we are accountable, even though the affect of the thing is a love story, no question.
Yeah, it comes through particularly in the histories you tell about the history of the Australian shepherds and how they develop and where they develop, and it really brings home. I mean, in a way, because we as human beings recognize that dogs are simultaneously these marvelous beings that we share our intimate lives with, and even people who are not particularly aware of history recognize that they're products of a historical interaction with human beings for any number of purposes. They're very, very potent ways to recognize the way in which our bodies are also histories, and that those histories are, you know, going to be mixed bag in most cases. When you look at, say, in the example of the Australian Shepherd, the history of the conquest of the West and ranching practices and the, you know, destruction of indigenous, you know, all of the violence that lies on, and not just violence, but also labor relations and how dogs function in and outside of you know, developing economies of ranching, et cetera. So all of that comes through very, very strongly. But I want to stay with this idea of encounter, because it's something we talk a lot about on the show. I'm interested in it from a lot of different angles. The way of living your life where you are open to the possibility of encounter with others, with systems, with the unknown, with marvelous resonating spiritual life partners, with all of this sort of wide array of possibilities, but that you kind of live sort of from encounter, or from the possibility of encounter, more than from a kind of imposition of a plan or a plot or some kind of grand scheme. But to have that kind of encounter with an animal, mm-hmm. with a dog, there's this sort of moment where some people would say, oh, you're anthropomorphizing. Oh, you're just projecting. That's not really what's going on. It's just an animal doing its own thing. And we as human beings layer on these kind of, especially now when people, are, so many people love their dogs so much and they're spending tons of money on them in the veterinary office, and they're burying them like humans, and they're increasingly part of people's families, which are in some sense no longer strictly human, which itself is an interesting topic. But I'm more interested in this point: what's wrong about that anthropomorphic critique? That idea that in that encounter with an animal, it's just our projection. There's something more going on there that's really important.
There's several things wrong with that particular account. First of all, it assumes that the world is made up of entities who are bounded into themselves and are conscious and who project onto the rest of the world whatever is going on internally to oneself. And so anything that such a being, call this almost a definition of certain Western notions of a human being, is always fantasy and projection and the relationality. It assumes that isolation is the fundamental ontological structure of the world, units and relations, bounded units that then have relations. And that if you've got two sorts of bounded units, on the one hand a dog and on the other hand a human being, the dog doesn't do language in the same way that the human being does, and so can't tell you what's going on. And so the only way you can possibly know what's going on is through processes of fantasy and projection. Is a really lousy ontological epistemological theater that it, you know, works off of the worst possible aspects of inheritance within Western philosophy. And I think the fundamental reality of the world, the fundamental ontology of the world, is relationality. And out of relationality, beings are produced as opposed to pre-existing the relationality. But the threads, the tangles in relationality are by no means all the same sort of thing. And what happens as a result of the entanglements and the processes is not known in advance. So on the one hand, I have a different theater of both being and knowledge that takes relations as the fundamental unit of being, not units. Something ironic about saying it that way. The other is that human beings project onto other human beings at least as much as we project onto other animals. I think if anyone is honest about any friendship or politics or family formation, the elements of fantasy about who we are with play an extremely large role in these relationships. And it's not necessarily a bad thing, but so of course we do that. human beings do that with other animals and do that out of their own cultural histories. The animals also have natural cultural histories. Dogs are not dogs are not dogs. Dogs who have grown up in various kinds of social ecologies are different sorts of entities that engage in different kinds of relationships than dogs who have grown up in other kinds of socioecologies. So I think fantasy and projection plays a role, but I also think that the other critters have non-linguistic opinions, if you will, have their own sorts of specificities for working us into their lives, that these kinds of co-formations go on from all sides. And there's no question in my view that any representation in writing or in performance or in song or in philosophy or in science, those are fundamentally the practices of historically situated human beings. And the critters that we're engaged with don't present their worlds to themselves that way, nor when we're in material semiotic relationship with each other, playing a game, doing some labor together, engaging in some kind of farming practice. The engagements of human and more than human beings happen with the kinds of specificities of those histories and those bodies. And that we produce accounts of this in representational forms is no surprise. In other words, I think the fundamental thing that's wrong with the story about projection is a kind of crazy-minded reductionism. If you can, that is nothing but, that our relationships with other critters are nothing but projection and representation. If you can outline the ways that any situated historical account of a human-dog relationship is culturally specific, economically specific, uses the genres of fiction or of biology, you have then reduced the relationship to the representation. I think that's wrong, bad faith, bad philosophy, a kind of bad consciousness. I think the notion that we reduce relationships to representations is the fundamental problem with that story. Yeah. And that engaging in actual encounters with other beings, human and non-human, biotic and abiotic, machinic and organic, that the actual relatings, engagings, are what produce the world. And that we're fools to approach this with a kind of nothing but attitude.
Yeah,
does that make sense?
Totally. And you are most certainly not a nothing but kind of thinker. One thing that when you said that, one of my fears, you know, as someone who's been tracking technology in a cultural, fictional, real capitalist sense since I read the Cyborg Manifesto, is one of my many concerns, is that capacity for encounter with a capital E is really in a tough spot, that in many ways we're creating conditions and for many complicated reasons in terms of how representations are working, how people are embedded in systems that are sort of whatever, concocting kind of simulated encounters as a sort of stand-in, to use that kind of language, forms of distraction, forms of programatizing or economizing all relationships. So it's just this kind of economy of representations that are moving around rather than that sort of openness and fear and joy of encounter. I have a lot of concerns about that, which makes me wonder a little bit how you feel that the possibilities and the potentials of this kind of engaged, heretical cyborg figure have changed now. Whether you see that the possibilities for the vitality and kind of critical and imaginative interventions within that cyborg imaginary, not looking at the ancient world, not looking at animals necessarily directly, but plunging forward into the kind of technosphere that we've now created, Has some of that potential been foreclosed, or do you feel like it's just that it's still there, maybe moving in different directions?
No, I don't think it's foreclosed. I think, if anything, it's been complexified and thickened, including the dangers, complexified and thickened, but not only. I think that this thing called the technosphere, the notion that the world is structured by spheres, is itself a very interesting kind of figural apparatus that I think I use, but I'm very wary of, the notion that you have these ever-expanding and englobing spheres, and that now there's this thing called the technosphere that somehow globalizes and obliterates prior or spheres of materiality. I don't believe that story, but I'm wary of that figure. That said, I think that let's take a kind of technosphere-ish approach to Anthropocene climate change issues, the kind of belief, proposal of techno fixes or the apocalypse, or the next stage of human evolution into the technosphere or extinction. These stories abound in the areas that you're talking about. Yes. I think part of the work that people like we do is straight up old-fashioned demystification, that these are really lousy fictions and they do us damage as beings in the world. And that engaging with the realities, with the realities of excess death and extinction and ecological destruction and vulnerabilities of, tipping systems for ecological well-being of cities and of, well, on and on we go, that the real urgencies that we are living within are made worse by the fantasies of the technosphere, that machines and digital apparatuses and apparatuses of virtuality of many kinds are not all that different, really, from other kinds of apparatuses for operating on the world, that the worlds of financialization are not nearly as powerful as our fantasies would have us believe, that the apparatuses of abstraction in technospheres are hyped, that some good old-fashioned demystification about the way hype works here, I think, stands us in good stead. And then I think there's nothing as bracing as actually trying to get something done in the world to give one a sense of the ongoing complexity of it all. So that people who are actually, let's say, trying to make really good computer games with and for indigenous peoples in various contexts that actually take up very contemporary indigenous stories that also make use of inherited stories and tie them together with the stories of other peoples and engage players. The way these kinds of games get tested on real life youth by real live youth populations, the way marketing apparatuses work for such games. I've been following one of them that got widely reviewed in the last year, Never Alone, which is an Inupiaq game that was done by Eline Media in collaboration with the Cook Inlet Tribal Council, produced a really amazing computer game that has all of the elements of high capacity technical skill, storytellers that work through many kinds of media, alliances between youth and older people, southern and northern peoples. I think there's nothing like getting inside of an actual encounter to lay out some of the possibilities, some of the dangers, to stay with the thickness and reality of it all, and to demystify the techno stories without becoming anti-technology.
Yeah, that is definitely part of the key. And one element of it that you do, and that in some sense we could talk about it in terms of the inherited stories of indigeneity and the way in which they function as in many complex ways for people trying to think through this sort of techno hype towards an engagement with real materiality in a way that's open to these encounters, open to the magic of these encounters, that there is a sort of, I don't want to say the word mythological, I don't want to say the word religious, I don't want to say the word mystical, I don't want to say the word magical, and yet something in that conjunction of words I don't want to say point towards something that's always intrigued me about your work. You know, the last line of the Cyborg Manifesto, which, you know, never left my brain once I read it, is you're talking about feminist responses to the new conditions and how there's these different figures of them. And you say, though both are bound in the spiral dance, I would rather be a cyborg than a goddess. And of course, the references here aren't just to the idea of a goddess, either of Gaia or some old organic notion of this sort of human divine and this figure of the cyborg, but also the spiral dance, which of course, at that point, coming from California, coming from my background, I knew that you were talking about Starhawk, you were talking right. about paganism, you were talking about feminist paganism, feminist Wicca, and that has been like a kind of bubbling line in your work. And there's a wonderful part in your conversation with Carrie where you talk explicitly about religion, both your own upbringing as a very believing Catholic, longer than most people believe when they ultimately leave, and how that influenced you, but also your interest in the earth, in the powers of the earth, and your willingness to invoke the names of, you know, Pachamama and Terra and Oya and that kind of a willingness to embrace whatever you want to call it, myth, magic, religion, I don't know what the word is. And that's important. That's really important to you in a way that I think is different for a lot of thinkers working in the zones that you do, maybe increasingly less so. But I'd love to hear you reflect a little bit about how that line or that sort of theater, that particular ontological theater has influenced you or it continues to be part of what you see as active ways to engage our moment.
Well, and of course, Starhawk and the I'd rather be a cyborg than a goddess and the spiral dance, all of your connections are exactly right. And it was also part of the nonviolent direct action anti-nuclear movement. It was the Starhawk spiral dance was specifically out of the spiral dance at the Santa Rita jail when the direct action anti-nuclear people were arrested together. So that and she was a powerful spiritual political leader in the nonviolent direct action movement. I thought that this was very much part of cyborg worlding. So first of all, the words, magic, religion, mythology, those three, all of them are the direct result of essentially a colonial Western classification of the world in terms of the hierarchies that move from magic through religion to science. They're part of a purification apparatus that works the world from primitive to civilized and ascribes the past, describes the past with words like magic and then religion, which is better than magic, and then science, which does away, which essentially fulfills the promise of both with real knowledge. It's a colonial apparatus. It's a colonial knowledge apparatus for organizing the knowledge and the practices of the world. So the words magic, religion, mythology, science need to be reconfigured. And I'm pretty much never ready to throw out the baby with the bathwater. So I'm actually unwilling to do without certainly animism and mythology, and I use religion sometimes. It's a little harder for reasons that have to do with the practice of right-wing religious movements in the United States, really. It makes it an almost impossible word to recoup. On the other hand, for that reason, all the more necessary to somehow re-inhabit and refigure. But I end up feeling a kind of lightness of being in terms of ontological judgment. I think the confessional question, do you really believe, in animistic processes. Do you really believe as a pagan? I think that request for confessional belief or non-belief grows out of the Christian Reformation. That
absolutely.
It's fundamentally a Protestant and Catholic practice. For the production of enemies and of each other, really, and that the demand to declare belief or unbelief should be avoided at all costs. So I leave questions of belief aside, and I'm way more interested in questions of how worldings work and how storying works and how people and other critters inhabit and perform worlding and storying. And for that, we would be fools to forget the many inherited stories that get called mythology. Fine, I'm happy enough with that word. I am way more interested in re-inhabiting and figuring out how to inherit and how to move on with. So, for example, on Facebook, I'm part of the friended the Indigenous Futurisms group. And I'm tracking some of the really interesting storying going on that rework inherited stories into other formats. This is an old practice across, various peoples of the earth. So I'm intent on blocking questions about belief and nailing them for the kind of colonial Protestant apparatus that they are, and trying to understand how worlding works with these storyings. So I sign up with, Eduardo Viveros de Castro and Deborah Danowski and their Thousand Names of Gaia world out of Rio de Janeiro last year, or a little longer ago than that now. I think the Thousand Names of Worldings are way more important than worrying about whether something is religion or mythology.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. The question of belief is really, a kind of dodge or a sort of move that's made on something that's much more complicated and multiple. I would love to hear you talk a little bit, since I think a lot of people listening to the show, and I'm myself included, are drawn to the resources, the power, the inspiration, the animism of indigenous worldviews, and that yet for whatever reasons we find ourselves not surrounded by indigenous people, and there's a kind of weird gap where there's a desire to connect, to learn, to be transformed, to encounter, and at the same time we can see very clearly, and even people who are deeply neo-tribal people who are interested in ayahuasca shamanism, who aren't particularly self-critical about the anthropological history and the violence of the Amazon and the rubber trade or anything like that. Even within those kinds of worlds, there's an increasing sense of the kind of damage that's done by poorly placed interest or falling in love in the wrong way. And I would love to hear you, since you do keep a very a subtle but profound relationship to, let's call it animism, let's call it worldings of indigeneity, what's a good way to work with this for people who see that need and yet are wary about mistakes?
Right. Well, let me preface some of my thinking about this with saying that none of this is instead of sciences, not capital S science, belong in these worlds in all sorts of ways and inhabit, both indigenous and non-indigenous worlds, contemporary and past, in all sorts of ways. But first of all, I think for people like you and me, certainly people like me, it's actually not true that we aren't in or can't be in ongoing intelligent conversation with Native American scholars, indigenous scholars, with artists, scholars, political activists, park managers, ecologists, so on and so forth, who it's entirely possible to become way more deeply informed and to know who is writing good stuff and who you need to be in touch with when you want to talk about something. And not to just go for a kind of new agey appropriationism and falling in love in the wrong way, as you put it. That it's a little bit like when feminists say to our would-be allies, you know, there's really a lot of stuff out there that you should read. You know, that you really can be more knowledgeable. And then we can continue this conversation. I think it behooves the descendants of settler colonialists, such as myself, to get smarter, to become more informed, and not simply to look to indigenous worlds as a sort of healing practice for the ills of civilization or some such nonsense. In that sense, I think that again, these are questions of engaging and encountering and becoming able to respond because of being a little less stupid in the evening than you were in the morning. And I mean emotionally less stupid, intellectually less, more open to the kinds of knowledge practices that are going on in the example we're using in contemporary indigenous worlds, which will really quickly put an end to a kind of romantic shamanism. That kind of relationship is pretty impossible to sustain when we start becoming a little less stupid about the complexity of our contemporary worlds and people who are working and quite capable of being in relationship that changes all of us, relationships that change all of us.
Yes, no, thank you. Very well said. I always encourage people to read anthropologists and to, in particular, and you know, contemporary anthropologists, and including you know many who are from themselves from indigenous backgrounds. And there's just a remarkable conversations that are going on that inform so many of these issues. And they're not that hard to find. You know,
it's not that hard to find. And the era of colonial anthropology really is dead, or perhaps needs a little beating down still. But there's just a whole lot going on that we can connect with.
Yeah, we have about 5 minutes left, and I even though it's not enough time to do it justice, I can't help but bring up the issue of the Cthulhu scene. I know that's part of your upcoming book, and I you know you have such a wonderful attention to words and to the possibilities of the images and words neologisms that of course it made sense that you would take on the Anthropocene, offer other suggestions, including the capitalist scene. But the one that's most interesting, and certainly interesting to a wide variety of people, including the kind of you know people who would be interested in cyborgs but not necessarily socialist feminism, is this notion of the Cthulhu scene. So please tell me a little bit why you came to that term.
Well, and it's a little bit. There's the germ of the Thulucene Manifesto in Manifest Lee Haraway, and then it gets really elaborated in the book coming out with Duke in September called "Staying with the Trouble: Making Kin in the Thulucene." And I decided to pronounce it as phonic, as opposed Lovecraft's Thulu, Cthulhu, is pronounced Cthulhu. He decided to pronounce it that way. And partly because my Thulucene actually has no relationship in its origin stories to Lovecraft. It's a different mythology and figuration that's much more related to Thonic than it is to Lovecraft's horrible patriarchal monster of the depths that's pronounced Cthulhu. So first of all, I pronounce it Thulucene, and it's a kinos. The scene is this era of thick time, past, present, and to come, a kind of thick timeliness is what kinos means, the scene, C-E-N-E part, and the Thulu part, C-H-T-H-U-L-U, I spell it differently from Lovecraft to differentiate it, has to do with the ongoing, not just ancient, still making the earth, making Terrans, that we are part of the ongoing tentacular making and unmaking of the earth. And it's not figural. It's not about a god or a goddess or a monster figure, but rather processual. The tentacularity of the earth and of earthlings is not finished. and that being engaged with the tentacular processes of the earth, with the depths of earthliness, is what gives us a way to continue with a kind of ragged joy and possibility to make the Anthropocene as short as possible. That kind of engaging in the trashing of the trash and extinction of the Anthropocene and the Capitalocene, kind of engaging in the earthliness of the Thuliocene, opens up the world to ongoing, including mourning the loss that we are currently part of. So the Thuliocene is a thick timeliness for engaging with the earthly ones, of whom we are, we are ourselves also earthly ones. It's about that.
Absolutely. Now, I one just clarification was, if you were not inspired by Lovecraft or even interested in sort of evoking his dimension, why did you could have made it the like Cthano scene or what?
Yeah,
there's still a Cthulhu in there.
I know, and I've been wondering what in the world happened. I actually had not read Lovecraft, but obviously I'd heard it. So when I coined the term Thuliocene, I didn't know that I had. It was a mismemory, I think. It was coined and in play before someone called my attention to Lovecraft, and I thought, oh my God, that's not what I meant. But by that time, the term was already in play and in print and
yes,
had to do with phonic plus kinos, and I decided not to change it. And some Lovecraft readers are really upset with me, and I don't blame them, actually, but differentiating it from Lovecraft is important to me.
No, I understand that, but I have to also say, as a Lovecraft reader, that it for me it works out just perfectly, and I think it's an interesting kind of encounter. And I understand both the need to differentiate, but I think that there are ways of framing the relationship that actually make it sense. But I'm afraid that would be another conversation as we wind up to the end here.
Lovecraft is richer than my cartoon caricature of the patriarchal monster. It's much
but
more interesting.
I look forward to the new book very much. I'm very attracted to the title. I think that's one of the ethical principles I try to live by, to live joyously with the troubles. And Donna, thank you so much for joining us on Expanding Mind. It was a great conversation.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right, folks, Donna Haraway. Let's see, next week, who are we talking to next week? We're talking to Kevin Kelly, another side of the technosphere, left to right. And till then, mind's open.